Welcome to the Savoy Originals. I'm Alex Zane, and this week I'm joined by a comedian, actor, and all-round tour de force of entertainment. The last 5 years have seen his star rocket, with appearances in the hugely popular Ted Lasso and his own Sky sitcom Intelligence, while his stage persona has become a viral sensation. Today we talk about how biding his time has seen his warm brand of comedy return to the mainstream, and find out how good he is at turning down roles that he subsequently turns into huge career moments.
Honestly, the tape I did, and I've put it online since, it's so bad. It's the most half-hearted. Apparently I was meant to send in 3 scenes. I just sent in 1 because I didn't even read the email. It's really bad. It must have looked so arrogant. There you go. That's got me the part. There's my 2 Emmy nominations.
Yes, my guest today is the wonderful Nick Mohammed. That's all on this episode of The Savoy Originals. Now, just before we get started, let's take a moment to thank Lauren Perrier for adding some sparkle to today's episode. While we enjoy a glass of Lauren Perrier Heritage, let's turn for a moment to their unique connection to the culinary world. Since the 1950s, Lauren Perrier has been crafting wines with freshness, finesse, and elegance designed to pair perfectly with French cuisine. Whether it's an aperitif or a wine to accompany the world's finest meals, Lauren Perrier has been a trusted partner to chefs and gourmets alike, enhancing every creation. So cheers to a tradition of great taste on the plate and in the glass. Nick Mohammed, here's to you, a true original.
Thank you very much, Alex. How are we going to do this?
There we go. Lovely stuff.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure. So I want to start today, as we celebrate your career and originality as a performer, by going back to the very beginning, because I think I'm right in saying, as a child, it was magic and card tricks that were your first passion, and using them to entertain kids at school.
I absolutely was really into magic, like properly obsessed with it. I got Paul Daniels' magic set, like a lot of kids in the 80s, when I was Well, in fact, it was my sister's. She was 7 and I nicked it. And I was obsessed with it. And yeah, absolutely did it at school to sort of, I say as a way of like surviving the playground. Not that I was bullied or anything like that, but it definitely, it was a way of getting attention, I guess. And maybe that's still true now. There's just something about the innocence of magic taking you back to childhood. When there's that moment of wonder, and even now as a punter, if I see something that I have no idea how that works, it instantly takes me back to childhood.
Because Paul Daniels was a fixture on TV. Mm. Was there something outside of magic in this kind of like, you know, he was the king of light entertainment, and he brought a warmth, a kind of a welcoming warmth to the way he hosted his shows.
And wit.
And wit, of course. Was there something about that that inspired you as a kid as well?
Yeah, definitely. I adore Paul Daniels, and I was lucky enough to meet him 2 or 3 times. I remember quite distinctly when I was about 13, 14, my dad had somehow managed to get Paul Daniels' agent's details, and he just cold called him up and said, my son's really into magic. My dad was quite bold in that way, and just said, can I just bring him to the office and just show you some, he can show you some tricks, and he just loves it. And I think the problem was, obviously this is pre-internet and social media and mobiles and stuff, I just didn't know. I had no other contact with magicians, and the only other outlet for it was going to the library, Headingley Library, and getting magic books out. But I'd sort of exhausted that really quite quickly, and so I did. I went to see Paul Daniels' agent in Manchester Way, I think it was, and you know, I was a kid, so it wasn't like, oh, this is the start of your career. But they gave me tickets to see Paul Daniels in some charity event in Middlesbrough, and I met him afterwards, and he said, where are you from? I said Leeds, and he's like, oh, there's some good magicians in Leeds. And he gave me the name of these two guys, Colin Fox and Harry Nichols, who were both like similar age to Paul Daniels, sort of had done the working men's club circuit really, and Harry Nichols, who must be 88 or something now, effectively became sort of like my magic teacher, tutor for, you know, a couple of years basically. And I would go around to his, he lived in Morley in South Leeds, and I'd go around to his house, and he'd just show me basically his act pretty much, and I would learn it almost verbatim and sort of, you know, bit by bit. he then put me in touch with the Northern Magic Circle, which had a junior section to it, which I had no idea. And they would meet once a month in Bradford. And from then it was like, oh, I found my people. And so it was, you know, from being into it at a young age to meeting Paul Daniels to kind of giving me those contacts. And it was back in the day, you just called these people up and then went round to the houses. I mean, it wasn't like, there wasn't the internet, there wasn't, you know, YouTube tutorials or anything like that of how to do stuff. You just learnt it from another magician or from reading their material.
And literally meeting these people. I remember meeting, I forget the actor's name, but I was at a Dungeons and Dragons festival because that was my childhood. And I met Mr. Bronson from Grange Hill.
Right.
And I was like, how do you get into the industry? And he was like, there's a book you need. This is a book. It'll list all the agents. And he was just like, there was a real graciousness and class about these people just offering to help a younger generation.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that was one of the things about the Paul Daniels Magic Show in particular, was it was always such a great showcase for lots of magicians. Obviously, he hosted it. But particularly the later shows, you'd get so many international acts over and some of the stuff. I mean, and this is in its absolute prime. It was getting, 10, 15 million probably people watching on a Saturday night. It was phenomenal. And I loved it and lapped it up,
So that's the magic. But obviously, you know, we know you as an actor. Now, when did you first become interested in drama? Because we've had guests on the show who have gone into entertainment, specifically acting a lot of the time, who really found that in the drama club at school. That was where their passion was ignited.
No, I didn't do drama GCSE, A-level, didn't go to drama school. It was really late. I mean, I was in my 20s, really, that I got into it. And I was always into comedy. And I guess all the magic that I did would have a comedy sort of slant to it. I would sort of have, I mean, I say funny, it wasn't funny really, probably, but patter. I was always do like funny patter, again, probably inspired by the likes of Paul Daniels and so on. And so I knew I was into comedy. I loved watching comedy on telly as well. But it was through university that I then started doing more comedy over magic. I'd still gig as a close-up magician, but I was really getting into comedy and joined the Footlights, which is a kind of Cambridge sketch group. But I was a postgrad, so I'd done an undergrad at Durham prior to then. And there was the Durham Review, which was the comedy sketch group. And I really wanted to get into it, but it was really difficult. They only had one audition a year, and it was only like for one or two spaces because it depended on if someone was leaving and graduating. It was quite a niche thing and quite cliquey, I think it's fair to say. It's not anymore, but it used to be then. And that was the only real comedy outlet. There were no other sort of student review groups or student stand-up nights or anything, so it was quite exclusive, and I never got in. I auditioned 2 years on the trot and never got in. So when I started doing a postgrad at Cambridge and realized that with the Footlights you could just audition every 2 weeks, and if you got in they would do a sketch show every 2 weeks, and you could audition with new stuff, and if you got in you got in, and it didn't matter if you didn't because you could audition again in another 2 weeks. And it was through that you then start to collaborate with people and do sketches, and I was doing character stuff rather than stand-up. But it was then that I sort of started to properly think of it as a possible career. Not that there was any guarantees, but I guess because certainly with Footlights, and it's a real privilege to say this, but there was such a tradition of people having gone through that process and actually making it, for want of a better word. And so that does instill something in you. You think, oh, well, maybe it's worth a shot, or maybe I could give it a go. And the reality is you graduate, you don't have any money, you have to move, you know, I moved to London in this instance, but and then was temping at Morgan Stanley in the day and then gigging at night. So I'd go to Morgan Stanley with like wigs and weird things in my bag. But yeah,
so it was because at this point you are, you know, you're doing academia, you were doing geophysics at Durham, and then you went on to do seismology
at Cambridge.
Was academia a safety net for you in case the comedy didn't work out, or was the comedy more something that was sort of pootling along in the background, but really you were kind of serious about a career in academia in some way? Which way was it?
It was the former, actually. It was weird. I have a very, it was really oddly romantic that it must have been, I mean, we're going way back, 2004, 2005. And I got into the show. It was another audition within Footlights where it was going to be the show that would then go up to the Edinburgh Festival and then do like a national tour in September. And there were like 5 places, and I got one, and it was like a dream come true because it was quite competitive to get it. And it was the one to kind of get because it was a big stint, and a lot of it was subsidized as well. So they would pay for your accommodation, not everything, but you know, it was covered. So it was like, oh, what a privilege. And the people who were on that were like Sarah Soleimani, Johnny Sweet. And so it was, and you know, who have become like great friends and stuff. So I got it, and I had to ask my supervisor. I said, well, I'm going to need to take at least 2 months off my PhD to do this. And he was genuinely so understanding. And he was like, well, yeah, okay, fair enough. But, you know, you got to crack on. And I remember so vividly walking away from the Bullard Laboratories, which was where I was based in Cambridge. And I turned back to look at the building. And this is end of July. I just turned back and I just knew I wasn't going to go back. I absolutely knew. And I had no idea what was going to happen or how Edinburgh might go, whether it would lead to anything or get an agent, or but I just knew for some reason that no, that's a really important kind of point in my life. And I just knew, and I really had such a strong feeling about it. It was very odd because I've never really had that with anything else, I don't think.
So you were doing part-time work at Morgan Stanley, and you were on the comedy circuit, yeah, at this point here in London.
That point, yeah,
you were doing it
like doing open spots and stuff, really, rather than anything substantial. But yeah,
so this was the noughties.
Yeah, mid-noughties. Yeah.
So what was your perception of stand-up, the kind of stand-ups that were seeing success at that period, compared to the kind of comedy that you personally wanted to do?
Yeah, I mean, telly was one thing. There was a lot of stuff on telly that I loved and was like, I think I could do that, or I'd love to do that. I'd love to write it. Not that I had the skills or the knowledge base to think, oh, I know how to write TV scripts or anything, but I would see stuff and think, oh, I love that. The live circuit was quite, I was going to say just quite toxic back then, very competitive, very alpha male, very stand-up heavy. I'd never done stand-up. I always would go on stage in character and would play various characters. So it was sort of a little bit going into the lion's den, I think, in the first instance. And I remember quite vividly doing nights at, there was a club, you'll remember it, called Ginglick. You remember the Ginglick in Shepherd's Bush? I don't know if it runs anymore. It's the one that used to be an old toilet.
Yes.
And they converted it underground. And I would come on. And we had the same promoter, a guy called Christian Knowles, who's lovely.
Oh, yes. He still runs the boat
gig.
Yeah,
he does. Absolutely. Yeah, at Tassel Castle, right? And yeah. Is that one?
It is the
The one
is
on the embankment, basically.
Yes, that's the one. Yeah.
And he just put me on this night, because he was going to be taking me up to Edinburgh, and he represented these other acts as well. And because I was doing character stuff, and I was like, oh, I've got costume changes. They were like, oh, okay. So we'll put you on sort of in between the acts. You can do like four of your characters or something. And it was really kind of him, because I guess I was trying out material. But all the other comics hated it, because they're like, I mean, this is just disrupting the night, because I wasn't really going down that well. It was really alternative. And they're like, we just need to kind of get the flow of a gig. And it's sort of like every time you go on it. And it was just like, well, you know, but again, it's character building, and you have to kind of work out who you are. But I knew I never wanted to do stand-up. I always wanted to hide behind a mask or hide behind magic or some gimmick. There was always something that I wanted to hide behind, and you know, it takes ages. That stuff, I feel even only now am I starting to work it out, frankly, 15-20 years on, you know.
But I mean, I feel ties into how I described you as such an original performer at the start, in the sense that, you know, the circuit was one thing, and there was a lot of cynicism, I don't want to say aggressive, I think you put it best, there was an alphaness about the stand-up circuit in the noughties. So to go on and do what you did, which was so at odds with what was popular right then, that must have taken quite a lot of confidence and quite a lot of assurance that you wanted to do something very different to what everyone else was doing.
Yes, that was definitely my... I remember quite vividly thinking, I don't want to put myself in the same sort of bracket. Like, I want to stand out by doing something different. It is just that thing of trying to break through a very difficult, competitive market, really. You have to put yourself through it if you're going to find your voice. And then the more you find your voice, the better you kind of get to it. So there is a positive feedback thing going on in there. But it's not to say there weren't a lot of tough gigs and tough Edinburghs and things like that.
I mean, well, let's talk about Edinburgh, because as I was just saying before we started, it was 2010 when I first saw you doing Mr. Swallow.
And which was the first hour I did. That was the first time I did an hour just as Mr. Swallow. And the rest had been multi-character shows.
I didn't know this at the time. This is until I started researching for this interview, because he seemed like such a complete creation.
Well, it was based on a teacher that I had, and you know, she would just use that platform as a teacher to sort of spout anything and everything at us, from, you know, stuff was on the syllabus to like her views on capital punishment. Like, she would just use it as a platform, and so innately confident, but without having any of the, like, but also being simultaneously incredibly clumsy, tactless, verbal diarrhea. I mean, it's endless. But there's a proper kind of old school end of the peer quality to him, because he does like to entertain and he was born to entertain. But there's always maybe a sense that he's not quite... There's a slight desperation to him, a slight sense of him trying to, you know, reach for more than he's probably really good enough for. So there's a slight... But, and as a result, a slight delusion of grandeur. But I guess the sting in the tail with Mr. Swallow in the live shows is often he'll present as this, and then actually at the end he does manage to achieve something. So whether that's like in the Houdini show, there's the water tank filling up and he's like, well, I've not learned it. And, you know, there's all this sort of stuff like, has he or hasn't he? Is he just pretending? Is he doing that for a theatricality or whatever? And then goes through with it and it actually all works and stuff. So there's all, I quite like the sting in the tail of doing a little rug pull at the end. But yeah, would I want to be friends? I kind of would want to be friends with someone like that because I'd find them hilarious, like really funny.
Did things change after that Edinburgh? Because to sort of look at your CV, it seems that that was when work started coming in, like where you started getting parts in TV shows like Drifters, Life's Too Short. Sure. Did that all come off the back of the success of that Edinburgh debut?
I think it probably did, actually. It was in between that and the 2012 show, which was the sort of second Mr. Swallow lecture. They were the ones which definitely I felt confident in saying, oh, I'm an actor as well, and I'm writing stuff for telly. And again, still no guarantee, still didn't know what I was going to be doing in like a year's time. It was still very much sort of, okay, I'm all right for the next 6 months or something. But I definitely felt comfortable in that I guess I don't mean this in an arrogant way, but that I had something that is worth kind of pursuing, really. And that with Mr. Swallow in particular, that was my way to find an audience, and that was my point of difference, I guess. Not to say that there haven't been other characters or other character comics, or that, you know, there's lots of northern comics and things like that, but it just felt like that attitude, that persona, that kind of old school vaudeville variety type act, sort of based back on, you know, Paul Daniels, really, that there was an audience for that, and that it was a really good way to communicate my sense of humor, basically.
I want to ask something that we ask every guest, because comedy is notoriously tough and a fickle industry. So why do you think you have succeeded where so many people have not?
Oh, God, I can't answer that. I don't know. I mean, it just comes down to tenacity. I'm very lucky in that I feel, you know, I'm blessed with strong mental health. You know, I've got strong sort of positive outlook. And I've just had a very good support network. You know, all the comics that I, you know, and people like Johnny Sweet, Simon Bird, Joe Thomas, you know, all those people, we were all at university at the same time. We've all supported each other. You know, we've all asked each other questions and trying to sort of just sort of find our place in it. And Ed Gamble, Nish Kumar, you know, we were all doing it at the same time. And we just all talked to each other. I mean, there, you know, we just... It is supportive, and actually character and sketch, as much as I said it was very competitive, like an alpha, that felt to me more like the stand-up circuit was like that. People who were doing more character and sketch stuff, or at least started out in that way, there was a lot more collaboration because you are in each other's work. You end up supporting each other in different capacities. So that really helped. And the fact that everyone has bad gigs, and knowing that that is part of the process, you can't start and be the best that you're going to be. And that's never happened. And I mean, so many people have said this before, but any success, any degree of success is founded on a series of failures, right? And as long as you're constructively learning from those failures, I mean, of course, if you're failing every time and not learning and you're adamant it's someone else and not your responsibility, then maybe you should stop. But there was always, even in the worst shows, there was always something to take from it. And you know, you learn more from your mistakes than your successes, arguably, right?
I mean,
especially in comedy.
And I would never name names, but when I was on the open mic circuit, and you'd see the same people on the same open mic nights, and like you'd have done a bit that went badly and you'd have changed it, and there were people who just did the same bit, like they didn't alter the material. You're like, but it didn't go well the last six times. Are you just going to do it
again? I mean,
there
are acts I've seen who, frankly, I love, but who almost deliberately split the room. Like, and that's their thing. And it's like they got off on that. Often they're clowns, frankly, you know, as in like old school kind of Lecoq kind of clowns or Goya or something like that. And they like that. And there is something exciting about that. But, you know, I mean, you'd have to have real, I mean, I don't know if I've got that much tenacity. I think I would struggle if I was like, every time you've only got 50% of the people with you, I think I'd find that a struggle.
This next period of your career, I mean, it's littered with 5-star reviews for your Mr. Swallow stage shows. Dracula, for example, you debuted in Edinburgh in 2014 before it moved to the West End. A show which The Guardian call you comedy's best kept secret. So, like, how does that sit with you? Were you happy being recognised as doing great work, like, within the comedy community and the comedy literate audience? Or were you sort of thinking, you know, I want to be bigger. I want to expand beyond the Guardian Edinburgh reviewer.
Yeah, it's a really interesting sweet spot, that, because, of course, the best compliment someone can pay you is from one of your peers or someone who's in that same line of work. Of course, you want the appreciation of, like, the comedy community, but that often translates to not necessarily mainstream success, not always. And in fact, you know, the comedy community can be quite cruel and a bit snooty about mainstream success, and, you know, almost like they're a, you know, a proper comedian is above that, and that something mainstream might be seen as easy.
I thought something that perhaps put both you and specifically Mr. Swallow on the map for a bigger audience was around 2018, 2019, when you appeared on 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown doing Mr. Swallow. A huge success. The YouTube clips of your appearance viewed millions of times. And it really does feel like that is one of the few shows on TV where you could showcase the kind of old school music hall entertainer that the Mr. Swallow character is. Did that feel like both an opportunity and a way to have reached a wider audience?
Yeah, it's credit to my agent and to Jimmy Carr and Zeppatron, really, because they pushed it. I turned it down like 2-3 years on the trot, which is like, I don't want to do it. I was scared of burning the character on telly because it wasn't a format that I was in control of. I wasn't in charge of the edit. I was like, if I'm going to put Mr. Swallow on telly, which felt like such a thing that, and even now, that I would love to do a sitcom of Mr. Swallow, but it has to be just right, and the timing has to be right, and I want to be all over that in terms of, I guess, the control of it and the presentation of it. And I was like, you know, is this going to work? They convinced me, and they said, look, you're in Dictionary Corner, you get to do your own bit, you don't have to interact with anyone else if you don't want to, you don't even really have to interact with Susie Dent. And then I went on, and I didn't know what I was worrying about, because it's the gorgeous gig, and actually it was above the kind of really competitive Alpha Mock the Week kind of whoever shouts loudest wins panel show. It was a lot more supportive. Jimmy was really supportive, especially of newer talent coming through, and particularly when they're in that Dictionary Corner spot. And you really got your moment to shine. And because I had, frankly, quite a lot of material at that point that would fit, because, you know, because I would do quite a lot of tricks and stuff in the shows, in the Edinburgh shows, it was quite easy to just take them out and put them in as those segments. And so they did do well in the end, actually, and I don't know what I was worried about before, and it definitely helped be the next sort of step up in terms of increasing the audience. So yeah,
being a guest on that show and bringing that kind of, as you've used the word before in this interview, warm, positive comedy of Mr. Swallow to a wider audience, and having it celebrated and having millions of people look at it on YouTube, and the response you got from your appearance, did you feel kind of vindicated for sticking to your guns in terms of what you wanted to do with comedy?
Yes and no. I never like, it's not like I think vindicated would feel like I had a point to prove, which I don't feel like I did. I mean, obviously I wanted to keep going with Mr. Swallow and exploring opportunities for him on telly, and I'd not really done that before then, but I didn't necessarily feel like, there you go, I've proved you. I still feel I'm on that journey, frankly, especially with Mr. Swallow, because funny talking about the start of the Mr. Swallow kind of career, as it were, in 2010, and the first time that being the first hour, and you could see people slightly sort of shifting in their seats, thinking, oh wow, he's going to do that for an hour, that's a test, right? That's a real test for the audience. And it was. And now that I'm gigging and, you know, playing bigger rooms and this next tour and so on, 40% of the audience have not seen me do Mr. Swallow. They've seen Ted Lasso. And so you have to go on that journey again with them. You come on and you're like, hello. And they're like, wow, what's this? And so you have to, it's like starting again, weirdly.
Now, as we sip on this Laurent Perrier Heritage, I can't help but think about its connection to the world of gastronomy. Earlier, we mentioned Laurent Perrier's focus on creating wines that pair beautifully with food. It's a tradition that began in the 1950s and continues today as they work hand in hand with chefs to elevate every culinary creation. From the first course to the final toast, Laurent Perrier brings finesse and elegance to the table, proving that great wine and great food are the perfect pair. Here's to unforgettable meals and the champagne that makes them shine. Cheers. I want to talk about a big year for you, which really feels like a sea change year, which was 2020.
The pandemic. It was important for everyone.
It was a big deal, yeah, a big deal. Yeah. And I really want to spend the next half of this interview really delving into what that was like for us all. It was the release of both your own created and written sitcom for Sky Intelligence alongside David Schwimmer, as well as appearing in the what was to become a behemoth of a show, Ted Lasso, alongside Jason Sudeikis. This really saw you become a much more of a mainstream name. I want to start with Intelligence because, like I said, you created and wrote the show. How did it get greenlit? What was the process?
So it was one of those slightly long-winded things. Julia Davis and I had developed, had been working on a sitcom called Morning Has Broken, which was a spoof of like a morning TV thing. Still on YouTube, I think you can find it somewhere. But it never got released officially, and it, various reasons, it didn't end up going to series. And one of the co-financers of it, it's such a long-winded story, but basically was Sony Studios. And David Schwimmer had been doing some work with them, and or even informally, the heads of Sony Studios sent this to David, said, "Oh, you'll really like this, right up your street." Just as a kind of, "Oh, you'll enjoy it," not as a work thing or a professional thing. And David loved it, and I think had met Julia before doing some improv stuff and or some theatre thing, and just got in touch and was like, "I'd love to hang out with you guys and do some workshop improv, and if there's ever like a role for me, maybe work out what that could be, you know, if it gets picked up." So we just had this glorious 3-day, and I was like so starstruck. I mean, it's mad. When I got that phone call, I remember my wife was pregnant with Finn. And this was back in 2015, I guess. I remember like putting the phone to her ear so she could hear it was actually him. I was like, it's him. It's really him. It's Ross from Friends. But I mean, he's a gent. I mean, and I love him, and we're in, you know, obviously still in contact and everything. But anyway, that didn't work out. Morning Is Broken, but David had said to me, like, "Look, if you're ever writing anything and you can think of a thing that would justify an American being in it, then you know, just let me know." And about a year or so later, I had a script commission from Expectation, who produced it. And I'd always liked the idea of setting a sitcom in GCHQ because I felt it's naturally funny that there are these huge national security sort of stakes and these sort of oddballs going around who are quite socially inept, I guess. And then it felt, oh, well, what if a disgraced NSA, you know, agent is forced to work over with the Brits? And there's obviously at the time when Trump was about to come in, and I was like, oh, this feels like, you know, fun territory. Sent, I think, like a page or so to David, like not much. And he was like, "Oh yeah, great, when we're filming it." And I was like, "What?" And I hadn't even written it. It hadn't been picked up or anything. And of course, once David was attached, people were kind of all over it. So it was great. Yeah. I mean, and I owe so much to him to be able to lean on his weight of experience, him having been in one of the greatest sitcoms of all time and one of the greatest sitcom actors of a generation, right? Such a clown. So gracious, so humble, so funny, like to the point that I almost took it for granted that he could just do anything with any line. And even sometimes not even a line, just a look or a physicality or something. Oh, those times were just the best. We had such a laugh.
And when you say you took it for granted, were there times where you were like, "Actually, David, if you try it like this," or did you just let him do David?
No, I was quite like, once we got to know each other and once I knew how collaborative he was, you know, there was initially I was like, "Do what you want, like you're in the show." To be fair, I found series one quite tricky, if I'm honest. It's the first thing I'd written as a full series on my own, and I there was quite a lot of voices in the mix, in all honesty. But I found my groove in series two for sure. I had a little bit longer to write that, again, because of lockdown had meant we delayed by 2-3 months. And he would take notes and he would want to work a scene or he'd improv bits. And he was so clever. All of us, everyone in that show was. And I was really proud of it. And it's weird because it's now on Netflix. And that only happened about 3-4 months ago. It's just found a completely new audience. And I think actually at the time, Intelligence was slight, you know, it's so silly. I mean, I tell people it's like a cartoon, really, but it's so stupid, really superficial. It wasn't very trendy to do a show like that at the time. It was right in the thick of the kind of traumedy, you know, comedy that's got a message and, you know, is really comedy drama. And really what I mean by that is drama with three jokes, really.
Yes.
And it would frustrate me a little bit that those were the kind of shows that were getting commissioned. Not because they're not good. A lot of them are excellent. But it felt to me like, again, there was almost like that snootiness of, oh, no, we're above comedy by doing drama. It's like, no, you're just a different genre. And actually, comedy, to be consistently funny, is really difficult. It's more difficult than drama. And so what's nice is for audiences to kind of find intelligence now that there's actually a lot more of an appetite for that now.
Well, that's great to hear. The idea that, because, you know, for a period, people would say the sitcom is dead. And, you know, the only way to get comedy on TV is as a comedy drama.
Yeah, and it's got to be 45 minutes probably rather than a half hour. But now I hear that it's all change again and they want laugh out loud, gag, half hour, workplace, sitcom, you know, that there's a drive for that again, which is great.
So if intelligence, what was big, Ted Lasso was huge. Appearing as Nate Shelley, do you know how you landed on their radar in the first place? Where the call came from? Because I know it almost didn't happen.
It was around May of 2019. So I knew that intelligence, we were about to start filming in like July, I think we're filming Intelligence. So I was sort of busy, but like I went up for it because it sounded, and I went up for two things actually. It was Theo Park, brilliant Theo Park, who was casting both The Rings of Power, the Amazon Lord of the Rings series, and Ted Lasso. And I went up for both, I think, on the same day because I went to their offices and didn't get either. And I was really out of my depth with The Rings of Power because it's all quite self-serious and, you know, it's almost written in verse. And they wouldn't send out scripts either because they're really, you know, confidential.
It's the most expensive show ever made.
And I kept on asking questions like, is this meant to be like Legolas? Who is it? And they were like, I can't say, but maybe, yes. No, don't ask. And then I went up for Higgins, which Jeremy Swift got, which is Rebecca Welton, the character's assistant. And it went fine, but didn't get it. And you just sort of think, and you move on. And then in the middle of filming Intelligence, so this is like, you know, a good couple of months or so afterwards, I got a call saying, oh, can you come in and audition for Nate? And I read it and I was like, you know, this is like a sort of subordinate role and there's an eccentric American who's kind of come over and he's sort of kind of taken by him. This sort of feels like the premise of Intelligence or the kind of character I was doing in Intelligence. I was like, do I want to do that? And I was like, you know what? I'm just really busy with Intelligence, maybe not. And they were like, and they kind of were like, can you just do a tape, just do it over lunch. Honestly, the tape I did, and I've put it online since, it's so bad. It's the most half-hearted. Apparently, I was meant to send in three scenes. I just sent in one because I didn't even read the email. It's really bad. It must have looked so arrogant. There you go. That's got me the part. There's my two Emmy nominations.
Time I've got for you.
Isn't it bad? But Theo had championed me. And like Jason, I think, was aware, had seen me do, like, knew I came from a live comedy background, knew I was into magic and stuff, had seen bits. And I turned it down like twice. And then Bill Lawrence called.
Oh, my gosh.
And was like, you just got to do it. And I was like, all right. And it was, and look, that sounds very, very arrogant. The practical issue was that I was right in the thick of Intelligence and I was an exec on that show as well. And I knew that we were doing another series of Intelligence at that point already. So I was like, well, I know I'm busy with the writing as well as everything else that comes with it. But also they had only written or they'd only sent like scripts 1 to 3. And so I didn't know where it was going. And they then, credit to them, they sat me down like right at the start, were like, just so you know, and they didn't even know if they were doing another two seasons or whatever, they were like, just so you know, if we get picked up again, this is what happens to your character.
Okay.
So they sold it and I was like, oh, that sounds fascinating. So I was like, I'll come up with a character and I'll keep all that stuff at the back of my head that he's going to go bad and then maybe redemption and all that. My goodness, did they stick to their words. And you know, I was like, thank God I said yes.
I was going to say, so you actually had an idea. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I knew right from the start.
You knew that you were going to become...
And it was one of the reasons for doing it, really.
Because he obviously becomes such an integral part of the story. And obviously it's coming back, just announced.
It is, I mean, whether I'm in it, I don't know.
You don't know yet?
Don't know yet. No, not for sure. I mean, look, I'd love to. But look, I've been very clear in the past. I had such a lovely 1, 2, 3 season arc. I wouldn't want to repeat it. And so from a creative point of view, I get it if there's no more Nate. But if there's a reason for him to pop back, then that would also be great. But, you know, it's very much about the women's football team. So there'll be a host of new characters. So they can't have space for everyone. So I'll get it if not.
And how life-changing was it, like being part of Ted Lasso? Because, I mean, obviously, it'd already been big in the US, and then it grew to
yeah,
be...
Yeah, sort of
to,
sleeper hit over here. Really,
it got bigger and bigger as more people saw it. And, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, it was behind, you know, it's a subscription, you know, Apple TV's a subscription, and yet it still seemed to just, like, find this huge audience. Did you feel that you were being noticed more? I guess... Both in person, seeing as you, I think you live around the corner from where.
Well, we were living, we'd been living in Richmond since 2014, renting. And then finally, and frankly, off the back of doing Intelligence and Ted Lasso, we bought a little flat in Richmond. And so we'd been living there for ages. And obviously, it was very weird that the show was set there. And certainly once it became successful, we've now since moved. But like, it looked like I was hanging out to get spotted. Because like, oh, what's he doing here? It's like, well, I live here. This is where I jog. Like, it was just, it was my kids get a nursery there. So it was just like, it was really odd. But I think one of the things, well, appreciate with doing live performance is that you kind of develop a thick skin. And doing Edinburgh and doing comedy in particular, you become ingrained with this, okay, look, every gig, it's a different audience. There might be just times when it just doesn't quite. And you have to accept that. And you're only as good as your next gig. And you just got to keep moving forward. And you develop a really thick skin because you know that everyone has sort of been there. And there's a lot of support for that, actually, within the community, and just a lot of literature written on, you know, just taking care. What nobody teaches you is what happens when something goes well. Like, there's no rules for that at all. And that makes sense because it's rare, more rare, at least, for something to be a hit. And particularly on the scale that Ted Lasso was a hit, because I guess it was a streaming platform, and it was a relatively new streaming service that Apple had introduced. Obviously, Apple's massive, but it was new. Apple TV was relatively new. And the pandemic, you know, so people were in watching something that happened to be very positive and optimistic and really resonated with people, because thematically, it just was what people needed at that point. So it was sort of this perfect storm, really. I mean, the show is great in its own right, in that it was bucking the trend by not being snarky or cynical, but it just took off, and none of us can deal with it. None of us can believe it. Not because we didn't have faith in it. We all thought it was good. We all wanted to do our best work in it. And of course, you would never enter into anything thinking, oh, this is going to be an astronomical hit. But like, we are still really wide-eyed about, like, oh my God. And there's a really, we're all like, well, no, we've got a WhatsApp group. It is active every day. Like, none of us can believe it still. We hear things like, Brad Pitt really likes it. Like, what? It's mad. But you just, nothing prepares you for it. And it has been life-changing. It is life-changing, and it's weird. And I feel like I'm still going through the change now, even as people continue to get Apple TV. And, you know, so it's that weird thing. I don't think I'll get used to it. I'll forever be grateful for it. I mean, it's... But yeah, it's like the indirect consequences of that are things like people coming to Mr. Swallow gigs and then be like, what the hell's this?
You talk once again about, you know, you've always... Your comedy has always been very warm and inclusive, and suddenly you're in, you know, this huge show, which is all about that. Like I said earlier, it's almost like the world is caught up with the brand of comedy that you've been doing from the start.
Yeah, no, that's nice. And actually, I think all of us feel... It's nice to be a part of a show that will, I think, has made its impact on the world. Like it has, it just has had that, you know, whether it will continue to have that impact, I don't know. But it will always represent like an emblem of a type of show, basically, that has done that. And it's really nice to be associated with that, and not to name shows or individuals. But I've had friends who've been in very successful shows and comedies, and actually the landscape has really shifted, and actually... When you rewatch them, you're like, I don't know if this is quite acceptable anymore. Or quite, it's just time to move on, and that's fine. Yeah. And as a society, we make those shows the big hits that they are, of course, and society changes. But because it's so positive, Ted Lasso, and I think optimism and hope and, you know, love, and it is always thematically going to be a really good thing, I think. So, yeah, it feels such a treat to be a part of that, and such a wonderful cast. Like, we're all very close.
It would be a strange world-turning exercise if suddenly Ted Lasso was like, God, that was of its time. I don't know what would need to happen.
Why are people being optimistic still? Yeah.
I want to ask you now something we ask all our guests, because you've traversed the entertainment landscape. You've worked in film, TV, on stage. With all the experience and knowledge you now have, what do you think it takes to be original?
Time. Frankly, time. Because you can't start off original. And I think it's fine. I've heard Derren Brown talk about this a lot, because I'm a huge fan of his. And he's spoken a lot about, at the time that he was breaking through with his Channel 4 shows, there were hardly any mentalists. within magic now, there are tons of mentalists, and a lot of them are very derivative of Darren. And it's sort of difficult not to be, because he owns that space. And he has spoken incredibly wisely about it, as I guess he's become more experienced and older and just more at ease, I guess, with who he is and what he does. That actually, it used to really piss him off, I think, when he saw people who were imitating him, or because you'd think, well, that's not original, that's what I've done. And but actually, it's fine to be inspired, and it's just all part of the process of trying to work out who you are, that you actually do have to take from, oh, I love French and Saunders, and I love that when they do that kind of thing, oh, and I love the nuance of The Office, and I love that, and oh, I'd love to do that. And obviously you try not to imitate, but you can't help but be inspired by everything that's come before you. And actually then you put it in your melting pot of who you are and try and be authentic. But it's really difficult, and that stuff takes time. And as I said before, I feel I'm only really starting to find that and be really comfortable and confident with it now, in terms of, oh yeah, I feel like I own this. Like, and if someone else did this, it wouldn't be the same as me doing it. And again, not in an arrogant way, but just in a, I feel like this has been the culmination of 20 years, or, you know, even further, if you talk about the impression of the teacher I would do in school playgrounds. So, you know, it just takes time.
We've touched on the success of Ted Lasso, obviously two Emmy nominations for your performance in it. And you've mentioned this already about Ted Lasso fans now coming to see Mr. Swallow, which is obviously a very different creation to your character in Ted Lasso.
Because Brett's been doing a lot of stand-up in the States, and I did a gig in New York. It's the first time I'd gigged in New York.
As Mr. Swallow. Of course.
And it was in the town hall. It was like 1,200 seater. It was packed because of Ted Lasso, not because of Mr. Swallow. and I did an hour and 10 minutes. And you could just, it was just the first 10 minutes. It's like, here we go. Come on. This is it. Yeah, this is it. You slightly have to lead them by the hand a bit. But I do like the challenge of that. It went well. Okay. In the end, it went well. And that is, they are some of the best gigs in terms of the most rewarding gigs, because you feel like, oh, I've got 1,200 new fans now. Or you kind of think, oh, I've done my job as a comedian. Don't get me wrong, it's delightful to go on and you've already won them before you even step out, because they know the character, or they know what the base joke of the character is, so they can just get on board. And but there's something rewarding about someone being unsure and then being like, oh, no, I like it.
Because you're a character, I guess, you know, with Brett, for example, he can actively reference Ted Lasso.
Sure.
But
I still reference it.
Oh, you do?
Increasingly, I've decided that there's no point in hiding away, because people know it's a character. Like, they do know. Deep down, they know it's a character. I've found that the safest way to kind of win them over is, like, right, come on, who's here because of Ted Lasso? And just deal with it right from the start.
Yeah, because sure, of course.
Otherwise, it's the elephant in the room.
Sure.
And actually, it really helps because they want to hear about Ted Lasso. I need to get it out of the way. And they need to hear the voice. And it's good for them to hear me in character talking about a show that they're really familiar with.
So are you as Mr. Swallow, saying Mr. Swallow is playing the character in Ted Lasso? Or is it just just a blur?
So for this next show I'm doing called Show Pony, which is, I performed at the BAFTA Film Awards.
I was there. I was in the room. I saw you do.
Alex is mad, right? It felt like a prank. I mean, of course, I was never going to say no to that gig, but I knew it was going to be really tough. So I'm now doing material about it. So Mr. Swallow breaking down his performance at the BAFTAs, because it's all on iPlayer. So I've got all the screen grabs of all the reactions to it. And so I do the set again and sort of break it down. But it's a really weird thing, because obviously, really, I'm talking as me. I'm talking about my experience of doing it. And there are other things in that show which are really my own experiences. And again, like Ted Lasso gets a little mention in there. But I've just found there's no point in overcomplicating it by saying, okay, now I'm sort of talking as Nick Mohammed, but I'm sort of still doing it as me, Mr. Swat. Because people don't care, actually. They just, if it's funny enough and if you can ride the wave a little bit, people are willing to suspend disbelief. And there's license, because they know that when they make that transaction of getting a ticket, they know they're coming to see. They're suspending a bit of disbelief when they get the ticket, I think. So.
And is this the first time with Show Pony that you are bringing in actual and doing it as Mr. Swallow?
Yeah.
So almost, I mean, without being reductive, Mr. Swallow is now almost a name and a character, but allowing you to do personal material.
Well, I felt like, yes, it's exactly that. And I remember watching Mark Watson for years do it in the Welsh accent.
Yeah, of course.
And then he dropped it. And it was like, he just, and you know, the content didn't change. He just sort of, and it was like, that's fascinating. And then I started doing bits of material where it was clear I was talking about stuff that I had experienced as an act. You know, there's bits where I talk about being in the Martian and stuff, but I'm doing it through Swallow because it's just funnier doing it through Swallow, and actually people are accepting of it. And as long as you just, you know, bridge that gap at the start a little bit for them, it's fine. And you know, it also gives the character longevity because now any life experiences I go through, I can talk about as Mr. Swallow.
I mean, I have to write, just this is just for me, but you're in The Martian, directed by Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Ridley Scott fan. How was it?
Oh, it was the first feature film I'd done. Mm. I got that gig off the back of Nina Gold, who cast it, who's put me in a few things since, who's a brilliant casting director. But she came to see Dracula in Edinburgh, Mia Swallow playing Dracula. Which was really, and she I think she'd only come because I think her son had seen Mr. Swallow before. So she was sort of not even there in a professional capacity, had found it funny, and so then got me in for this really dry American role in The Martian. And it was just like, all right, yeah. And then I happened to get it. And it was this really weird thing. I remember going into audition, and then I did a tape maybe, then went into audition, then there was maybe a recall. And then I remember getting called by my agent saying, okay, Nick, just to let you know, Nina is going to recommend, like, it's almost like when you have to make an appointment with the queen, you have to agree to it before they've offered you the role. So there has to be an etiquette. Like, if they say to Ridley Scott, this is who we think, I have to have already agreed that I was going to do it. So right. I knew I was really close, which is a really weird thing. You don't always find that out with castings. So I knew I was close, and that, you know, it would just be his final call. And then, yeah, got it. And then it was really nice. I filmed it in Budapest rather than California. It's quite cold. I was just massively overwhelmed. It was the first American thing that I had done, as in an American accent. And I had these vocal coach, like I had an accent guy who I worked with called Rick Lipton, who's brilliant. He gave me these like 41 sentences to say things like, Mr. Miller remembered he had climbed many mountains. Dan and Ned ran from the barn into the... And it was all these like tongue twisters, but which got you into the right vowel sound. Because I was like, okay, if I'm going to do it, I can't be worried about it because I'll stress out because it's a big film set and it's Ridley Scott. And I was with like Chiwetel and, you know, various Sean Bean and all these people. And so I learnt the script almost like it was a different language. So verbatim, I knew the vowels, I knew the exact intonation. I was like really prepped. Got there, Ridley Scott was just like, improvise. And I was like, okay.
Wow. Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah, but he was really nice. And because he's from the noise, from Hartlepool, right? Yeah. He was like, oh, where are you from? And I was like, I'm from Leeds originally. And he's like, oh, I know Leeds. It's a good art school in Leeds and art college in Leeds. And he was just like, yeah, he was really nice. And, you know.
Because he's famously not really an actor's director. He's like, people should know their stuff. Just do your stuff.
He was very much, you know, it was in the 3D booth. And, you know, he kind of came out at the start and the end, really. But it was no real performance notes. Mm. You're sort of expected it once you've got to that point to just do it. And the cameras were massive because they're like 3D cameras, so they sort of shape like that, so it's like a big alien behind you. It was weird and overwhelming, but really fun.
We're almost at the end of our time together, unfortunately, Nick, but we do have three quick fire-ish questions to end on today. So we have made our way through a tiny portion of your achievements over the course of this interview, but what is it in your career that you are most proud of?
Weirdly, not many people I wrote a kid's book called The Young Magicians and the Thieves' Almanac. It took ages. Again, it had come about in a really organic way. And it took me years, like 3 years. But it's a thing. The idea that it's a tangible thing, it doesn't require me to go out and perform it. Like, it's just, it exists on shelves. And I'm like, ah, I wrote that. And I can flick into it. I'm like, yeah, I wrote that. And like, of course, scripts exist on my laptop for intelligence. And there's a record of Ted Lasso. But there's something about something as tangible as a book and it being a book maybe, and it's not short, it's like a good length, and I'm like, yeah, I wrote that. So that's what I'm most proud of. Hardly anyone's read it, by the way.
Okay, next up, tell me the most valuable skill you've ever learnt through work, the one that changed the way you do things.
It was a thing that Darren Brown, in his book Notes from a Fellow Traveller, which I would recommend for any performer, even if you're not into magic, just because it's a really, it's effectively like a journal he kept whilst touring. And it's really interesting about what it means to be a performer and you know, going through old material and not being but it was a thing about making your performances more about the audience than you. Like, it's a temptation with magic in particular and mentalism for it to have an inherent arrogance, and I'm the powerful and I know this and I can, you know, and you're the applause cue. And actually it's nicer for the audience for it to be about them. And actually, increasingly, if I ever do stuff as Swallow now, the like the tricks and stuff, I'm trying to make it more about them. And the stuff I did like with my son, like my story is more about that. Like, it's just try and sort of shed the kind of the ego.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it's worth reading his book. It's phenomenal.
Even with stand up, you do find that, you know, once you've engaged, like, I mean, on the most basic level, a little bit of crowd work. So you go, you know, I am aware of you in the room. And like, if the MC has named certain people, name checking them and, you know, making it like,
Brings them in, makes them a part of it completely.
Final question then. Can you give me one piece of advice that you'd give to someone else wanting to follow in your footsteps?
Do not be afraid of failure, because success is built on lots of little failures, basically. And to just try and stay as strong as possible mentally and physically, but mostly mentally, because it's really tough, and it will forever be tough. And you know, we're sat here and it's lovely to talk about my career, but you know, I don't know exactly what I'm doing next year. I just don't, you know. Hopefully I'll be working, but you never know. So it's just trying to keep level-headed about it, and just trying to remember that that might have been a bit icky or a bit difficult or a bit troublesome for whatever reason, but trying to learn from it and, you know, try not to make the same mistakes again, I guess.
Well, the next thing you are doing is Show Pony. Good luck with that. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Nick. Thank you so much. A final cheers.
Thank you, Alex.
Pleasure.
Thank you for having me. Absolute pleasure. Oh, look at that.
And that's it. Thank you to our producer, Matt Hill at Rethink Audio, to our sponsor, Lauren Perrier, and of course, to Nick Mohammed for coming in today. Join me again when we'll be opening the Savoy's Little Black Book to welcome another celebrated guest and ask them what it takes to be a true original. Until then, follow us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bye-bye for now.